It's been a very long time since mammoths, cousins to the elephants, wandered across the landscape in our part of the world. But if you look closely, and we mean very, very closely, you can still see evidence of their existence. A University of Oregon professor recently published his findings of mammoth tracks in Oregon's high desert in Lake County at the appropriately named Fossil Lake. And it's not just a story of mammoths once being there, it's what they were doing. Let's hear the story. Greg Retallick is the professor of paleontology at the Museum of Natural and Cultural History at the University of Oregon. Hi, Greg.
Good morning.
Good to have you here.
Yes, excellent. Thank you.
I have to start with the place. We have to believe there's some history already discovered at Fossil Lake.
Oh, the place was discovered in 1876 by Thomas Condon, who initiated the fossil collection that we have here at the University of Oregon, which is now Oregon's official fossil collection.
That explains why there's also a city of Condon in eastern Oregon.
There is. That's a fair way north. Condon's an old family in the state.
So I kind of knew where Christmas Valley was, but when I found it on the map, I noticed that the lake bed itself is miles away from it, and it looks like miles from civilization. What's it like out there?
It's bleak, but very interesting for a geologist, of course, because it's still actually loaded with fossils. The big fossils are hard to come by now, but even now you can see a lot of fish bone that tells you that even though it's dry as a bone now, it once was teeming with life.
How long ago was it like that?
Well, it's a complicated stratigraphy out there, but we think the lakes came and went between about 600,000 years ago and about 13,000 years ago. The particular level that we looked at is about 43,000 years old.
So finding trackways is not like finding fossils. Can you explain the difference?
Oh, yes. The trackway is a kind of a plimsist. It's a marker that someone was there, but you don't actually have the fossil itself. And you can tell a lot from a fossil because you've got the actual remains and you can often get it down to species. But with a trackway, what you're looking at mainly is the behavior, how fast they were going, what they were doing, which direction they were going, things like that.
So what is it about the geology of the area or any other factors that preserves things so well?
Well, that's a very good question. We have lots of theories about what preserves fossils well, and usually it turns out that fossils are where you find them. You need a certain sort of condition to preserve bone, and that condition is a highly alkaline condition. Acid will etch them away completely. So a lot of rainfall is acidic, and so that's dangerous to preserve fossils. From the point of view of preserving trackways, you can imagine trackways, if they're exposed for a long period of time, just dry out and blow away. So you've got to form them, and then you've got to cover them up fairly quickly to preserve them in the way that you can interpret them.
So did you have to dig to get to these trackways?
We didn't have to dig very much, actually, but we did need to get a permit from the Bureau of Land Management, and we had a wonderful team of photogrammetry experts from the Bureau of Land Management to help us as well. It turns out the trackways were only under about 5 to 10 centimeters, what's that, about 3 inches of loose sand. And so we just got some stiff-haired brooms and brushed the trackway off. There's a lot of trackway out there. We didn't want to sort of ruin the environment by excavating a lot of it, but we found 117 tracks in an area that was 8 meters by 20 meters, which is like an average living room, I suppose.
Well, a big one in some cases. But
Yeah,
63 feet on one side, sure. Well, that's really fascinating, though. So you're basically swept up, and there were the trackways.
That's right. That's right. And you can see others. That's what put us onto it. You could sort of see them at the surface because the tracks themselves are, well, we think they're mammoth tracks. It's the only animal large enough to make these big crater-like impressions. And you can see these crater-like impressions filled with dark sand, and they contrast with the white matrix, which was a volcanic ash that the mammoths actually trod down.
Greg Retallick is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a professor of paleontology at the University of Oregon at the Museum of Natural and Cultural History. We're talking about his discovery of mammoth trackways in the high desert at Fossil Lake in Oregon, which is in northern Lake County, east of Klamath County, if you're keeping track of how to get there. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. You might have questions or comments about evidence of mammoths out there and all that entails. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So the Pleistocene era Columbian mammoth is what we're talking about here. Was that the prevalent mammoth of the region, the only mammoth in the region?
Pretty much, yes. And we actually do have bones of Columbian mammoth from Fossil Lake that were collected a long time ago, including a complete hind limb that was excavated in the 1930s. The area is quite famous for its Pleistocene megafauna, and the issue, of course, is why it all went extinct.
And we think that's because of overhunting, don't we?
I'll tend toward that view myself. There's a very interesting story there, actually. Once the megafauna went extinct, the whole ecosystem changed. So we know from the fossil soils associated with the fossils that there was grassland out there back in the day when they were living there. And then when the big mammals went away, the grassland disappeared and you got the sagebrush steppe that you have now. We think there might be a connection. We think that we're actually looking at the disappearance of what many people have called the mammoth steppe, that the mammoths were actually creating this grassland with their dung and with their grazing. They promoted it in a way that when they disappeared, it could no longer be sustained.
Oh, so their activities kept things like the sagebrush at a minimum?
Right, right. The idea is an idea that's promoted by Alan Savory among a number of other people, is that the disturbance regime of large herbivores, and that would include cattle, wildebeest, mammoths, a whole variety of herbivores, can only be handled by grasses. Sagebrush is too delicate to handle that kind of predation or that kind of grazing pressure.
The kind of impression that the mammoths left that created these trackways, does that speak of some sort of spongy or at least moist ground?
Yes, it would have had quite a bit of moisture to it, and we see that the impressions are varied in their depth. And some of them have kind of concentric marks in them that look kind of like the ground was quaking as they stepped in, and others of them are up on a slightly drier soil. The whole surface of the soil is quite lovely. It's cracked like a lizard skin, and it's a kind of soil called a nitrogate in the technical speak of soil scientists, a kind of a plier-like soil that preserves the trackways best.
I noticed that nitrogate. I'm looking at your work in the journal published. With the effective date of today, Paleogeography, Paleoclimatology, Paleoecology. The article is called "Late Pleistocene Mammoth Trackway from Fossil Lake, Oregon." Greg Retallick, the lead author of five or six, it looks like, and our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. Here's a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, good morning. Greg, this has always been a fascinating field for me. What do you think of the catastrophism argument for the extinction of large Pleistocene mammals? Some kind of single or multiple catastrophic event?
Well, I'm very sympathetic to that. And, you know, there's a group here that was at the University of Oregon, the Kennett father and son, who proposed a comet impact at the in the Younger Dryas to create the Younger Dryas climate anomaly. And they had shock quartz and iridium anomalies and all sorts of, and diamonds, all this sort of thing. I think that's a pretty interesting argument. They seem to be getting more and more evidence for it. The hunting is also pretty hard to resist, and it could be that both causes played a role. Climate change, I'm not so sure, was all that important, because these mammoths and the whole megafauna survived many climate changes through the Pleistocene, as you know.
So they weren't just Ice Age animals?
Yes.
All right. So how long have mammoths been gone from that landscape in Central Oregon?
Well, the whole North American continent, except for a few Arctic islands, about 11,000 years or so.
Mm-hmm. And any idea what the age of what you're looking at these trackways is?
We're looking at 43,000 years.
Oh, okay.
We're pretty sure of that. We can correlate the volcanic ash layer around. And, of course, as you know, the University of Oregon, our archaeologist Dennis Jenkins and others have put human humans back in that part of the world, not far away at Paisley Caves, back to 14,000 years or so.
And pre-Clovis, which is the indication.
That's right.
Right, yeah, which is what
That's
makes
right.
it
But
system.
The Clovis culture is probably still the one that took down the megafauna the most, in addition to this possible comet cataclysm.
So there are some unique features of the trackways you found out there, Greg. I mean, what did the tracks themselves indicate in the movements of the animals that made them?
Well, we were kind of stunned at this trackway because you may not believe this, but a lot of mammoth and other elephant trackways have been described, and almost all of them stride out like a sergeant major so that the tracks are well spaced. But this one, the tracks were very close together, and the impressions of the feet on one side were much deeper than the impressions on the other side. This was an animal that was limping. And the other fascinating thing was there were juveniles associated with this group. There was a mature animal that was going right through. I think we have about 30 of her prints. And she was suffering. She was limping. But the young ones were coming in and then being overridden by her, as if they were coming in and checking on her limping and then going away again. So we think it was an injured mother, and maybe her young child, and a couple of other juveniles as well that were checking on her. It looks very much like a matriarch in trouble.
Do you draw the inferences from the behavior of elephants now?
Yes, and they do that, and it's you don't see it on too many nature documentaries, but elephants can actually break a leg or injure themselves in this way pretty easily, usually just by falling over, and they do stick together and bond, and you've almost certainly seen documentaries of elephants mourning the loss of their kin.
Greg Retallick, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. An email here from Denise Fern, it looks like. She says, we've known Greg for years. The enthusiasm he's presenting on air is and always has been infectious. He's a treasure all on his own. So you'll have a fan club, Greg Retallick.
Well, thank you.
Does your finding of these trackways change anything that we thought previously about mammoths or their behavior?
It just cements what we kind of suspected, that these were elephants in more ways than just their appearance, that they were behaviorally elephants as well, that they were in a matriarchal herd and they had strong family bonds. The link of the mammoths with the grassland palaeosols is also pretty interesting, this idea of the mammoth steppe. As you may know, there's a movement afoot to rewild North America and try to bring back the mammoth steppe as a mechanism of carbon storage, because if we can change the ecosystem from a sagebrush to a grassland, we get about an order of magnitude more carbon in the soil. And as a management possibility, this is one of the few ways in which we can actually get carbon dioxide out of the air and into the ground.
It is a fascinating thing, though, to think how much the ecosystem and the creatures that live in it are dependent upon one another. It is a complete cycle here in the way you're describing it.
Absolutely, but I think what a lot of people think is that the animals are adapting to the environment, and that's true to a certain extent, but also the environment is adapted to the animals. I mean, we're undoing the carbon storage of soil quite ferociously, but for millions of years, these grassland ecosystems with big herbivores were actually storing carbon in the ground and creating the cooling that brought on the ice age itself.
We have to ask about the level of detail you get from the trackways. It sounds like you have some very sophisticated measuring equipment.
Oh, yes. The team we had from the BLM was absolutely superb, and I was so happy that they came on board. With the technology we have now, we can make a digital image in three dimensions with a resolution of 1 millimeter. This big slab, 20 meters by 8 meters, we can actually print it up if we had the money and the equipment. It's quite remarkable how we can document these things these days. And with something like this, it's very hard to bring it into the lab. It's very soft. So these techniques were really pivotal. There's a lovely video online, too, that was done by Dean Walton using a drone.
I saw that. It was a very impressive video, yes.
Mm.
And I saw there's another shorter one, too, where you're out talking to the camera.
Oh, yes.
While somebody's digging behind you.
That's right. That's my grad student, Adrian. He did a fine job for us.
Adrian Braz?
Braz, yeah. He pronounces it Braz, yeah.
Okay. Quick call from Alan Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Greg Retallick.
Well, thanks for taking my call. My question to the professor is, where did those mammoths evolve? Did they evolve in this area, or where did they evolve from? And the other question, in Discovery recently, they talk about cloning mammoths from DNA collected from the thawing of Siberian ice in South Korea. They are doing that process.
Mm-hmm. Well, the fossil record is pretty interesting on these kinds of scores. We normally think of horses and camels as being old world creatures, but they actually evolved in North America. Elephants, on the other hand, that whole lineage we can trace back to Egypt in the Eocene, and it's pretty much an old world group. The first elephants, which were gomphotheres, came across to North America about 18 million years ago. And the mammoth group, there's basically two species, the woolly mammoth of the far northern hemisphere, and that would be pretty much Canada all the way through Siberia, and the Columbia mammoth, which is the one that extended all the way down into Mexico. Those came across the Bering Land Bridge during the Pleistocene and were very, very widespread. And your other question was, are we going to see mammoths again? Yes, I think so. There's a group working on the genetics of trying to create a mammoth out of an elephant.
Wow, that's impressive stuff. Okay, so watch this space, because more things could be happening with mammoths. And I apologize for referring to these as woolly mammoths earlier. I didn't realize the difference between those and Colombian mammoths. But
oh, yeah, the Colombian is the one we have. It probably wasn't so woolly. But since we have the woolly mammoth and the actual wool and everything else that we want frozen in Siberia, it's not that difficult a task to get the DNA you need to do the job, I've been told. I'm not that kind of scientist, but I think in a couple of years we will see some mammoth-like elephants.
All right. Greg Retallick at the University of Oregon Museum of Natural and Cultural History. Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.